Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Front Line.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 4th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from not in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building, not in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. In fact, I am on the road and having massive, massive technical problems. Just massive. Starting the show late, and I'm going to end it early. And more or less, this is just going to be a placeholder, folks. Just did an interview with Digby, and I think I will run it. Because I couldn't, for some reason, my tech setup wasn't working well. I couldn't do a live interview. And so I pre-taped one at the last minute. And for some reason, my voice comes out sounding like I'm from a horror show. And in fact, it is a bit of a horror show. I am in California at the moment, and I had an opportunity to sit down with Marc Maron yesterday. I will play that tomorrow. I will figure out my tech stuff. I will find someone who knows how to work this system. I don't know why I've been able to do it in the past, and I can't do it now. I cannot figure out what is wrong with it. And it's simply somewhat of a disaster here. Not as much of a disaster as the entire debt deal has been. And, you know, it's interesting. I've been driving around in California listening to talk radio. I have spent so much time in my car out in L.A. going to, frankly, ridiculous meetings that aren't going to lead anywhere. But I've been listening to talk radio and hearing all these fanciful, and I'm talking about liberal talk radio, and hearing all these fanciful notions of that the trigger is great, it's going to kick in, we're going to cut $500 billion from defense, and then don't worry about the other $700 billion that are going to come out of Medicare and discretionary spending. The trigger's going to kick in. They're never going to come up with a deal. Well, they are going to come up with a deal, folks. That's the gist of my interview with Digby. The interview is sort of annoying because she obviously sounds wonderful, and everything she has to say is great. And I sound horrible. It is, for some reason, it was slowed down. I can't figure out why. And so I will just tell you slightly about my thought about the trigger. I talked about this last night when I was on the Young Turks. And it's in the interview with Digby, but I'm going to leave that towards the end of the show here so that if you decide, like, that's just too annoying, I can't listen to one person who's talking at normal speed and another person who seems to be talking at a very slow speed as if he was like, I think it's like Freddy Krueger is what it is. I think it's like Freddy Krueger in that one of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. I don't know. I never saw it. I'm assuming. Maybe it was the chainsaw guy? Anyways, this is how I think it's really going to go down, is they are going to come to a deal. We don't know the outlines of this deal. It's going to involve The cuts to Social Security, probably in the form of that chain CPI. It's going to involve cuts to Medicare, probably in the form of a raised eligibility age. And the way that they're all going to come together, even though Republicans refuse to raise taxes, and even though Democrats insist upon raising revenue, the way I think they're going to come together, and there may be other things that they come up with, the way that I think they're going to come together is they're going to allow for corporate repatriation of their taxes. Because we've talked about this many times in the past. It happened back in 2003, 2004. To repatriate the trillions of dollars of profits that are in that are hidden overseas, essentially banked overseas by U.S. corporations, the deal would be, well, what we'll do is instead of paying the 35% tax rate that they are owed on that, we'll say you only have to pay 5% or 10%. So in the end, we will get maybe a half a trillion dollars worth of tax of revenue, maybe less, $300 billion. The Democrats will say, we've just been able to raise $300 billion more of revenue. And the Republicans will be able to say, we actually cut taxes. We didn't lower taxes. I mean, we didn't raise taxes. We actually cut taxes. That'll probably be the deal. Now, I outlined this in my conversation with Digby, but like I say, when I said it, it's really annoying. I don't have the capacity to cut it out right now, so I'm going to run this Digby thing. I will be on tomorrow. I will figure it out. I don't know what is wrong with this. If I have to buy new equipment, I'll buy new equipment. If I have to hire an engineer for tomorrow, I'll hire an engineer. I will figure this out. I promise you, I just don't understand. I literally spent 3 hours last night working on it. I spent this morning working on it, and I just can't get it right, and I don't know why. Here is the so I'm going to end the live show now, and I will tack on Digby onto the podcast, or I'll try and figure out somebody who can, and that will be the show for today. I'm sorry. Believe me, I've never spent so much time doing so little in my entire life. But I guess that's sort of like the beauty of California. So let me just go to the Digby interview and. Then the show will be over, and I promise I will be back tomorrow.
So, Digby, here we are again. The debt deal is now settled, and apparently it is also partly the liberals' fault for not espousing the wonders of this debt deal. Tell me, give me your sense of this, aside from the obviously the obvious that there shouldn't have been a debt deal in the first place.
Well, it's still kind of hard to tell, but looking at the early polling, it looks like it didn't work out very well, at least in terms of public opinion. I mean, nobody likes it. Democrats like it better than most, but even then, extolling the Democrats' approval of the deal, it's not exactly sky high, and there are pieces within the polling that are kind of bad news in terms of liberals. Liberals are really upset about the deal, or at the very least, they may support the president in the deal, and I think that's more because the Republicans behaved like such asses. But the deal itself, they are very unhappy about it and unhappy and believe that the president gave away too much. So that part doesn't look so good. But obviously the White House wasn't really concerned with the Democrats or the liberals in this deal, since they were basically not considered. It was the independents that we understood that we're going to be thrilled with the compromise and how terrific it was that we were dealing with the debt, and they hate it. They don't just, they're not bland about it. They actually hate the deal. And worse, oddly, for the people who got everything they wanted, the Republicans hate it too. So it's kind of an odd situation for the president. I mean, he's still hanging in there with the Democratic Party for the most part, although there are cracks showing, you know, now in that facade. But everybody else and the one group that they were allegedly appealing to here really don't like it. So it looks to me like this was not, on a political level, a particularly successful gambit. On a policy level, of course, it was a disaster.
And, you know, as far as I can tell, this only gets worse. I mean, I actually don't believe, and you had a piece up today, I guess it was either today or yesterday, I'm completely turned around right now, but talking about how there's a good chance this is going to end up chipping away at President Obama's signature piece of legislation.
I was stunned, actually, to see that. I mean, I've been writing from the beginning that I thought the one area, and I've been wrong all the way along, because I made an assumption that turned out to be untrue. I assumed that the president would do anything he needed to do to protect that one piece of legislation. And that would include pretty much protecting most of the health care programs, because they're all part of the Affordable Care Act. You know, and Medicare, of course, I just assumed would be sacred, you know, on ideological and philosophical grounds, number one. But number two, because, of course, that was a political weapon that the Democrats were anxious to use against the Republicans after the Ryan Plan came out. Well, it turned out that Medicaid, which was a huge part of the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of Medicaid, and the one liberal part of it that truly most liberals had to search their souls in order to be willing to vote against the bill. I mean, that was the point at which you had to say, can I vote against something that will expand Medicaid this hugely, bring in millions of people into the healthcare program for the poor? And you know, you ended up, at least I did, and I think a lot of other people did too. I said, well, you know, this is the one piece I can't walk away from. So, you know, I ended up sort of reluctantly supporting the healthcare plan. Well, I kind of knew that over the long term that was probably going to be vulnerable. That would be a place where when Republicans were in charge, they would go after that because they just simply don't believe in that program. Helping the poor is something they just can't, you know, they can't countenance. But, you know, as it, over time through the negotiations as they were reported, I saw Medicaid, of course, was in the original, part of what the president proposed when he was working on the grand bargain. Then it turned out Medicare was on the table too, raising the eligibility age for Medicare. That was shocking in itself. Now it turns out that, you know, that they did not protect in this deal the idea that these subsidies could be touched. Well, that's the very basis of the Affordable Care Act, is the idea that you would mandate people.
Weren't we told though that those were off?
Well, it was supposed to be, but yesterday I read that John Cohn in the New Republic, who follows this stuff very closely and is very well informed by people. They protected the subsidies, the tax exemptions, you know, that you can do and you can write off your premiums on your tax. But there were other things that were going. There were other subsidies that were going to help make this affordable, in terms of out-of-pocket costs. And I think, as we all know, there are a lot of out-of-pocket costs in medical care, you know, from deductibles to,
right,
you know, we don't know about prescription drugs. I mean, there are a lot of things in there that these additional subsidies were supposed to cover. That's evidently on the table. That surprised me. I mean, if you're willing to go after your signature legislation, you're willing to let that slide. And they apparently in the administration admitted it. It wasn't like they said, oh, we didn't see that, or that was a mistake, or, oh, no, that's open for interpretation. They confirmed it, that's on the table. And I don't think there's any doubt they're going to go after it. I mean, you know, why wouldn't they? That's going to be a prime, that's going to be a prime spot where people look for, yeah. So,
prime,
yeah, exactly.
Prime target. Well, so all right, let me ask you this. I mean, there's some arguments out there that the trigger is inevitable, that the trigger is going to get pulled. I mean, aside from the fact that I think some of those savings in defense seem a little bit dubious, and they're just basing them on on sort of astronomical projections that, that weren't necessarily baked into the cake. And aside from the fact that the other half of this is you know the Medicare provider cuts, and then somewhere else in discretionary spending, do you have a sense that the trigger is actually going to happen, or do you think that this super Congress is going to come to a deal, and that their deal?
Well, that's
will
what
pass
I think.
In the House
I mean, I think
Senate.
That's the idea. I think that's what everybody. What everybody wants. A lot depends on who gets named to the committee and whether or not they can come to a deal. And then, of course, the idea of if they can come to a deal, can they pass the bill? It's just an up or down vote on the whole thing, like the base closings. And I have little doubt that they are going to come to a deal. I have a feeling that they're going to put the people on these committees that will do it. That will find a way to do it, and I don't think it will be beneficial for Democrats. I mean, if you're judging,
let me give you a sense of what my nightmare is. On the committee, there's going to be all you need is one senator, right? To make it 7-5. All you need is like one Mark Warner, or even Dick Durbin at this point has said that he's willing to cut Social Security. And here's my nightmare scenario, which I don't know why I think this is going to happen, but we know that the Republicans won't
right.
Won't
that's
have
that's
any
not
with
going
any
to happen.
Tax
yeah.
increases, and we know that the Democrats are supposedly
right.
insisting on revenue increases. So the big sort of like the perfect have your cake and eat it too
right.
is the tax repatriation deal. Right, where they get the revenues, but there's no in tax increases. In fact, they're actually
right.
going to raise revenues by
Isn't
cutting
terrific?
Taxes in this situation. That's going to be I'm fairly convinced that's going to be the sort of the thing that brings maybe even two senators, Democratic senators, on board. And then, is there any way to stop it? Once it gets past that committee, it seems like it's just there's no way to not. There's no way. For
I don't
that
think
not
so.
To pass.
I mean, I don't see a path. To stopping it. I mean, they would have to put some kind of poison pill in the thing that was bad enough that it would create a backlash against one side or the other. And I just don't see them doing that. I mean, if they've learned one thing from this battle, they've learned what the end game is for both sides. And, you know, I think you and I both know what that is. So I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, they're not going to put in anything that the right is going to object to in the House. And the Democrats, I'm not sure what their limits are. I mean, they would have to throw in something just, I don't know, concentration camp for liberal children or something in order to make that unpalatable to them. Because, although people, yeah.
Or
centrist
or
children, yes,
centrist,
exactly.
Centrist children.
So I don't know, I don't know what will come of it in that case. I mean, one thing I do know is that there isn't really a good scenario either way for Democrats. So that, the idea that somehow we're going to embrace these triggers is kind of amusing to me because they're insane too. I mean, the amount of cuts that are in there, regardless of where
right.
they're coming from, is the exact wrong thing to do in this economy. And, I mean, I'm all for defense cuts. I think it's terrific. Let's cut defense if there's one area of the government that should be. But like you, I'm very skeptical about that side of it, and I don't have any expectation that you're going to see anything real there. And what you are going to see is more cuts to discretionary spending under the triggers, which really is just
right.
unaffordable for this country. We're going to start seeing what it's like to live in a banana republic if they keep this up. Because all these government programs, they aren't just, people seem to think that this is all soup kitchens or something and to hell with the poor. I mean, this is the stuff that we live on. This is our food safety. It's for look what's happening with the FAA right now. I mean, we're going to be lucky if planes don't start flying out of it, falling out of the sky over stuff like this. That's why we live.
And
that's our standard of living in a first world country is dependent on a lot of that stuff. And the idea that they are just going to hack into it, with a machete is ridiculous. But so the triggers don't appeal to me. I'm not looking at that as going, well, gee, I really hope that's what happens. I mean, perhaps it's the lesser of two evils, but geez, you know, this is bad either way.
Right. I mean, this is either a Satan sandwich or a Satan's crap sandwich. And it really just remains to be seen which one is going to be the Satan sandwich and which one's going to be the Satan's crap sandwich, because we could be looking at, we could be looking at basically eligibility to Medicare at 67 and then sort of, I guess, a chain CPI for Social Security, you know, cuts that amount to like
10-15% right. on both
right.
programs.
And I mean, the consensus that's emerged from this whole process that, you know, Social Security must be cut. It just must. We have to do that. We have to deal with Medicare and the only proper, you know, yes, we'll cut the providers, but we have to, you know, raise the eligibility age or something, is, you know, it's more solid than ever. I mean, what I hear on TV when you listen to the villagers and the media people, there's just no question that they believe this must be done. This isn't, you know, there isn't any pushback at all that maybe we shouldn't do it. We shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't deal with, you know, that we shouldn't touch beneficiaries in any of these programs, that this is an absolute wrong thing to do. I don't hear it. I don't hear it coming from anyone. And that's a very dangerous place to be. There's nobody holding the line. Which means that even, you know, the best case is a compromise that's pretty awful,
because there's nobody holding line.
Right. I mean, this is sort of like eerily similar to the, you know, late 2002, early 2003,
yeah.
where there just seems to be this sort of tidal wave of thought of establishment belief in the country that. You know, we've got to go invade Iraq, and anybody who says otherwise is a nut. I mean, literally is a nut, and it definitely has that feeling. It's rather depressing, and I don't want this to be totally depressing. what's the good news, Digby? I mean, what can we do at this point? I mean, I guess to a certain extent, is it. Are you at the point now where you're, when you look at President Obama, are you saying that, like, I'm still at the hold the nose and vote stage? I mean, are we at the
– well
where are you
yeah.
in this? I mean, I know it's obviously early. You don't have to vote now. And but I'm just curious because I think people are sort of like our types are just sort of walking around now in sort of like a stunned.
Well, my feeling about, you know, about
voting
as opposed to, you know, actively working for someone to be elected is that, you know, we all go into the voting booth, and when you're in there, you make a decision. And sometimes you don't decide at all. Maybe you just don't vote. I've done that a few times in my life for various offices. I think I've always voted for president, but I have, you know, sort of abstained from some votes. But, you know, for the most part, I do believe that, you know, at the end of the day, you end up picking, you look at the choices, and you make the one that you can live with. And for me, I'm not at the point where I'm going to say I can't vote for him, but boy, do I know a lot of people who are just saying it outright. I don't know how I'm going to be in November of 2012. If we continue this way, it's going to be hard. But, you know, I also don't feel that empowering the right wing at this moment in their trajectory with more power than they already have is a very good idea. I do believe that the administration has been complicit, but I can't even imagine what it's going to be like under a Republican. Now, you know, I think that unfortunately for the president, I think that people are going to be looking probably at a Mitt Romney, who is a far less scary prospect, I think, than people realize. You know, he's an ex-governor of a blue state. He's, you know, businessman, blah, blah, blah. I mean, he may present a stronger challenge than I think he should have had the president, you know, been a little bit more combative, because he's looking weak. I mean, that's the obvious thing, and that's just the heuristic of it. It's not, you know, I'm not necessarily condemning him for his strategy, because I think he actually wanted the strategy that he had. So I don't consider that weakness. I think that was just a bad strategy or a bad ideology, maybe both. But, you know, as we go forward here in the next year, it's going to be very interesting to see how that shapes up, because, you know, if they nominate Michelle Bachmann, we, you know, forget about it. It's, you know, it's over. But if they do nominate,
right.
Romney, I think in particular is the one, and you know, I mean, I think he's, you know, it's like voting for a mannequin. I mean, the guy is completely empty. But that, you know, does that really matter? I mean, look at they elected George Bush, so it's not like it's impossible for that to happen. So, I don't know. You know, I'm unhappy, but I've been unhappy. You know, this isn't really new for me. I've been watching this grand bargain unfold from the beginning, and I hated it the minute I heard it. I knew it was a loser for Democrats, and I knew that we were looking at a situation where we were going to find ourselves the very fundament of liberalism and Democratic politics chipped away at by a Democratic administration, and that's been very, very painful to watch.
At what point do we see Nancy Pelosi or somebody in the
I don't think that'll
House
happen.
Start running against
I honestly
him.
Don't. And, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel that, you know, the nature of his historic presidency, you know, the first African-American president, I think
right.
he is facing, the kind of radical opposition that scares people. I just don't see anybody in the Democratic Party being willing to take that on. Under different circumstances, if a Democratic president were doing his policies and in his position in terms of polling, I think you would see a challenge from the left. But I'd be very surprised if that happens. I think it's more likely, you and I talked about this last time, that maybe a Bloomberg candidacy or something like that comes along to shake things up. That would be thought about it after you and I talked, the more I thought, there is an opening here, you know. Whenever there's an opening, there's political space for somebody to come in and run. You often find somebody to do it, you know. I mean, the world is full of ambitious people.
Well, I guess I meant more specifically, when Congress people go out and try and get themselves reelected, do they run in part against Obama? I mean, you know, do they say we need you need to have me in Congress because I need to protect more of Social Security or Medicare? Because at that point, I do think it's going to be have been cut. I think the cuts are going to take place, or you need me to reverse this. And it's not going to happen with President Obama or President Romney.
Well, I suspect
gonna
that's going to happen even if Social Security and Medicare aren't cut, at least in certain districts. I mean, I think that where, you know, where there is liberal discontent, you're certainly going to find that. They'd be fools not to. I have no doubt that the primary opponents that are coming, that primaries that are going to be run, the open primaries, and perhaps the challenges too. There aren't very many announced yet. Everybody's kind of waiting to see what happens with redistricting and what have you. But in places where they have announced, there's going to be a battle on the left. In fact, the PAC that I work with, Blue America, with Howie Klein and John Amato, and we raise money for progressive candidates. We have a candidate up in Northern California who's running in what has been redistricted, but is still essentially Lynn Woolsey's district. Very, very liberal. And that's going to be a battle on the left. And certainly those kinds of things are going to be run on much more liberal terms and run against, I shouldn't say run against the president, but they're certainly going to be running against his policies. And I would imagine exactly what you're saying, that they're going to be saying, look, you need me because you're not going to get any protection from the Democrat in the White House on any of this stuff. And the idea of forming the kind of bloc that could actually work as a bloc. I mean, this is something progressives have never done. They're not used to it. It's going to take them, and it is taking them a while, to see themselves in this light. But they are beginning to do that. There's some leadership on the progressive side, guys like Grijalva and Keith Ellison, Donna Edwards, people like that, who are organizing on that basis as a progressive bloc in the House. I think we're going to start seeing that happening. You know, it's not traditionally the way Democrats do things. But, you know, in light of the other side, this new Tea Party caucus, the Blue Dogs, you know, I mean, this is, we're becoming more a quasi-parliamentary system. And there just has been, and you know, they work in blocks, and so the progressives have to organize themselves that way as well. So we're starting to see a lot of that, certainly a lot of discussion about it. I mean, and there's been a ton of work done on that over the past few years. You know, the progressive movement, I mean, I've been reading an awful lot about how, you know, we really dropped the ball because we made it impossible for, you know, we didn't do all the hard work of allowing Obama to do the right thing, you know. And I don't know. But, you know, it's like I really we have a lot of power. The presidency, it's the weakest office in the world, the president of the United States. He can't do a thing without, you know, progressive bloggers backing him all the way. But the fact is that the movement, which was semi-derailed over the 2008 election because – well, just because, you know, for a lot of reasons, but one of them being that I think a lot of people thought they were electing one of their own. That turned out not to be true in the sense of being a member of the progressive movement. But there has been institution building going on through this whole thing. I mean, there are things happening there, and mostly it's happening at the less than presidential level for obvious reasons. One of them is in the House, where there's a lot of work going on with the Progressive Caucus there. There's an inside-out game that's been developed. There are progressive online PACs, Netroots groups. You know, there's MoveOn, which obviously is the big institutional player for the last decade of the Netroots. But there's been a whole lot of things, like Blue America, which has been around since 2006, the PCCC, which does similar work and is now working in campaigns, helping progressive candidates. And this is all happening at the House level mostly, somewhat in the Senate, and somewhat on the larger media stage where, you know, groups like ours come in and do, you know, we'll target ads in districts and do things like that to try and shape the you know, the narrative, or try and, you know, shape the way Washington is looking at an issue. Those things are becoming more mature. They are still, you know, it's not like everything, we're just a bunch of bloggers. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff happening. And, you know, it takes time to build these things, especially when you don't have the Koch brothers backing you, you know, by, you know, financing your conventions and buzzing people in from Peoria like they do. I mean, so, you know, we actually are grassroots, so it takes a little bit more effort to get that stuff done. So, you know, so I think that that is going to happen, and in a weird way, it'll probably be a relief for the movement to turn its attention toward the nuts and bolts of electing people to Congress. That's a place where you can have a real influence. I mean, on the presidency, I never felt like the Netroots had any kind of influence on that presidential race, other than to fight with one another and spend a lot of time acting like, you know, 8-year-olds.
Well, so I guess there is a silver lining after all. I want to end it there, Digby. I'm looking, even if there's a slightly gray, dull gray lining to this, I'm going to perceive it as something of a silver lining.
Yeah.
Blue America PAC.
It's at Crooks and Liars. Blue America. John Amato is one of our principals, and you can find it on Act Blue for donations. And we have it's a campaign 2012. We've got all of our candidates and various things up there. Thanks so much,
Sam. Always wonderful to talk to you. Thanks so much.